This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we continue our series of American dressage legends as we hear about Gifted, the first horse to be inducted into the Roma Foundation USDF Hall of Fame. But first, Annie Morris offers our trainer's tip this week, which covers the turn on the haunches. Annie Morris from Columbia, Connecticut, is a USDF certified instructor through fourth level, a member of the Instructor Trainers Program training first level faculty, and a USDF bronze and silver medalist.
The turn on the haunches, I want to describe to you what it is. And of course, whenever I want to do that with a movement, I look at the directive ideas from a test. And the directive ideas require that the turn on the haunches has regularity, bend, activity of the hind legs, and is fluid and the correct size. So what that means is the horse performs the turn on the haunches at the walk, and the walk remains regular. He'll shorten the stride and turn the front legs around the hind legs without losing the activity, with a specified amount of bend, and in a fluid way. So that's what I would like to talk about today, is the correct turn on the haunches. So why do we teach the horse the turn on the haunches? Well, it shows up at second level because it's a way to engage the horse, meaning they have to carry more weight on the hind legs. There's no way they can do that turn without adding a little bit weight to their hind legs. It also frees their forehand, meaning that the shoulders have a little bit more freedom. They have less weight on the front legs, and you're asking the front legs to kind of cross over each other, so it loosens up the front end. The turn on the haunches is a precursor to the walk pirouette, which shows up in fourth level and actually is also in some of the FEI tests. And the reason that we teach either the walk turn on the haunches or the pirouette is because the horse stays active and engaged, frees the front legs, and it teaches the canter pirouette. Once you can understand the aids for that, doing it in the canter will be a lot more simple when you get to that level. Also, the ability to engage and stay active is what allows you to be able to teach the horse eventually half steps and therefore piaf. So now I will tell you how we go about riding the turn on the haunches and some common mistakes. Before you can even think about doing a turn on the haunches, you want to make sure that you have solid basics in the entire training pyramid all the way up to collection. So your horse has to have a good rhythm, be relaxed, connected, have impulsion in general, although you can't have impulsion at the walk because there's no thrust. And also be straight and therefore collected. We're not going to practice the collected walk until later on in the training. But before you do the turn on the haunches, you have to be able to shorten the walk. That's what it says in the test. And so it's just a few steps of a shorter walk. And the thing you want to watch as soon as you start thinking about shortening the walk is that you don't lose the rhythm. Rhythm problems in the walk are surprisingly easy to come by and surprisingly hard to fix. So the rhythm has to be your number one priority whenever you're doing anything in the walk, especially here, because if the horse gets a little tense or gets a little off your aid, it's possible for him to maybe get lateral, and that will make your whole walk work harder, but it definitely won't help your turn on the haunches either. So when I think of shortening the walk, I think of the walk I want when I'm preparing to do a halt transition from the walk, because the horse can't be taking their giant medium walk step and then on a dime stop and have a nice square halt. The steps coming into the halt, the horse has to shorten a little, and that's basically the amount of shortening you need for the turn on the haunches. Of course, you don't want him to slow down. You don't want him to actually stop, but that little half halt that makes the preparation steps is similar to what you want in the shortened walk before the turn on the haunches. Then you use to do the turn on the hunches, you use your outside aids to turn him. So that includes your outside leg and your outside rein and your feet. For example, your entire hip on the outside all the way down to your heel. That whole piece of your body turns the horse to the away from it. The inside aids in the turn keep the horse bent. So just like many of the lateral movements, you're keeping your left, let's say we're turning left, you keep your left leg forward, your right leg back. The left rein asks for a little flexion, and then the right rein and leg turn the horse to the left. Before you do a complete 180-degree turn, which is what's required in the test, when I'm teaching the horse, often I'll do a quarter turn and just see if you can get a couple of steps where the horse understands what you're trying to do. You say a little whoa, and then a little turn, and then let him walk out of it. Also, that prevents him from getting tense if that's what his tendency is. Once I'm confident in that, I can try the half turn. And then another thing I do often, actually, is do a full turn. Because sometimes the horse, I mean, he's obedient, he's trying to do the half turn you're asking for, but he loses a little bit of the coordination, and maybe he wants to slow down one hind leg or something. If you stay in the turn, sometimes you have more time to explain exactly what you want, but that requires also some expert aiding on your part to make sure, again, that you're not causing the turn actually to get worse. And you're, in fact, helping it get better. A couple other exercises I like to do, even when I'm just teaching the turn, is to do either a quarter or a half turn and then trot out of it immediately, because that kind of keeps the horse thinking forward. You don't want to teach him it so much that he does it for you in the test, because in the test you walk out of it. But that way he maybe stays a little more active, a little more forward thinking. Another thing you can do is canter out of it, but what you'll want to do is if you're doing a turn on the hunches to the left, you would pick up the right lead because you're activating in that turn on the hunches to the left hind leg, and then that's the leg that pushes off into the right canter. So even though you have to change the bend, it actually is a really helpful exercise to pick up the opposite canter lead from the way you turned, and it'll help your upward canter transitions. And again, this is especially useful for maybe like a second level horse to really teach them that active, shorter walk. Some common mistakes in the turn on the hunches are first that the horse steps out, and what it'll look like if you're watching this is it looks like the horse is kind of turning around the middle, like the girth stays in the same spot. The front legs kind of move one way, but then the haunches are moving the other way. So he's spinning around his middle. To fix that, the rider normally needs more outside aids, and especially the outside leg back to keep the horse from stepping out. Another thing is sometimes the rider turns the horse's front end too sharply, like maybe too much inside rein, and that'll force the hunches out. So it just requires a little bit more technically correct aiding sometimes to fix that problem. Another problem that's pretty common is that the horse sticks, and normally that happens because either the horse kind of gets behind the leg and isn't thinking forward enough, or that the rider turns the turn too small for the horse to keep the activity. The turn on the hunches, it's big enough that the horse should be able to continue to take steps with the hind legs. The hind legs won't cross. They stay walking without crossing, but the front legs will cross. And if the horse is trying to stick, you want to take a step more forward, like towards the nose, to keep the legs moving, even if it ends up being too big for a test. That'll help the horse learn the mechanics of the turn on the hunches. Another problem is that the horse kind of spins around the turn. Maybe he even keeps a rhythm, but he goes too fast and he falls like around the turn really quickly. So he does it in just a couple of steps. And that's normally because the horse is falling into the inside leg, the rider's inside leg, and falling through the horse's inside shoulder. And again, the rider needs more inside leg and to push the horse more forward towards his nose. Even, again, if you make the turn the half turn, maybe you'll have like 10 steps and it's huge, but that teaches the horse to stay in front of the inside leg and not just fall around the turn. So those are the main mistakes that I see and the basics of how to ride the turn and also why we do it.
And now for our featured segment on American dressage legends, we hear from Carol Lavelle and her story of Gifted.
I found Gifted as a four-year-old in Germany, unbroken, a very undeveloped horse, and obviously, as I said, unbroken, never been ridden, and I needed to try to sit on top of it to look down because it's one of my rules for buying a horse. You can get a rude surprise when you first sit on a horse, and when they threw me up on there and held him down, and there I sat looking down at a pile of bones, not necessarily arranged in the order I thought they should be arranged, but big, big bones. And he was unfriendly to be around. He bit and he kicked. Obviously, his early handling was not anything special. And he was of very, very famous bloodlines in Germany, a Hanoverian, as I said, by Garibaldi Zwei, who was a Grande line, and out of a mare who was Lombard Lugano. And all of those bloodlines are really good dressage horses and good jumpers. He got his name because he had to be a G according to the nomenclature in the breeding system in Germany. And I sat down and started to look through a dictionary in a G, and I was staying with a German family. And I came up with, I saw it Gifted in their English, and it was translated into German as this or that, or whether talented or whatever. So I thought, well, Gifted in English, that sounds like a good name. And then I saw the biggest word next to the German translation was a gifted tree, meaning the poisonous one. And when I named him Gifted, the people in the room and the family said, why did you do that? And that means poison in Germany. And I said, well, in English it means talented, but a gift from a special gift, coming with a special gift, not one that a rider creates, but something else. And they said, oh, just talented. I said, no, a pianist is talented. This is a gift from. And he came with enormous self-carriage. That was the biggest gift, because big horses don't normally move like that and don't have that athletic ability. Well, we called them Big G all the time. Get the G, the Big G. We never had any other names. I mean, there were some other names occasionally. When he kicked his stall down or rolled all the time and got caught in the walls or did not agree with any horse who had happened to eyeball him through a stall wall and he would attack the walls. He got friendlier as time went on, but he was difficult to be around. By his skeleton, I should have known the size of his bones that he was going to be an extraordinarily huge horse. There are many 17 three-hand horses, and I own one now, Much Ado, who's just as tall as Gifted was. But we're talking about a horse that grew to at mature weight 1,900 pounds, a fact I discovered when KLM put him on a pallet and then before putting another horse on said, we need to weigh this one. And I was sharing a pallet with another horse and half the cost, but in the end, I had to pay for all three stalls because they just put him sort of standing slant ride in a three-horse pallet. So he was an expensive horse to ship around. But that was his mature weight. And for breeders, I think, he would have been a throwback to traditional German breeding, which in the years past was big, heavy, lumbering type. And he looked like he might be one too, except when he moved. And I thought, well, you know, you could lose this movement when the horse grows up. And I only saw him trot. I didn't see him walk very much. He didn't want to be led out of the arena, and so he struggled with that. I only saw him take maybe half a stride of canter, and we couldn't get him to canter even in the big indoor ring they had. And I was not able to canter him for a long time when I got him broken because I needed big, wide open spaces to do that. But it was unexpected that he grew to such an enormous weight, but what was really unexpected that he could lift that off the ground and fly like no other horse. And people began to come and watch him. Gifted was quite submissive in the lower levels, but as we got to the big demands on his body and for him to stay, as we say in dressage, in a round frame and do that work in that way, he didn't like that. And a lot of the time we would have training problems with this. I needed him to do it our way, but there was no way a little 121-pound person like me was going to take a 1,900-pound animal and make him do anything. Once I realized that, it began to be on his terms as well. And we had a nice compromise. It was definitely a situation where we were a partnership and it wasn't a slave. And he was his own person. And he had his own method of expression. And you had to let him do some of that. And you just couldn't stifle it just to be robot-like and mechanical in doing your dressage test. And that's what I think made the horse very great. He had his own way of doing things, and you have to let him go that way. Thank goodness it was appreciated by the judges. Gifted was very easy to train, especially to break, because he had not the temperament to buck a rider off or run away. If he ever did run somewhere, it was because he was afraid of something. But to resist a rider, never. I think that the first thing you do ride on a horse is his temperament when he's first being broken. You see the most. Then you have many questions later on when he's developed. But the first questions are, will you go my way? And in my barn, the horse that I want to ride is a horse who's going my way all the time. The problem with Gifted was, thank goodness it was March or April, and we were in my small indoor, because he was always going. Once you got on and started to trot, where was the fire? And he did that his whole life. He was always going. I think he was my whole career, really. My other horses before him were all three Grand Prix horses that I started myself and got a lot of help from my coach, Michael Poulin. This was the fourth one coming up, and he was not like any of the others. First, I thought he was a lot easier to ride than any of the other horses, possibly because he was always going, and a very, very, very willing partner, and I wrote an article about him being the volunteer dressage horse, and he was. The one thing that was the most difficult thing for me to deal with and to learn was a horse that has a long back and is higher behind than in front, and a short neck. It would be difficult normally to collect according to the principles of conformation. However, that was the opposite with Gifted. He could get himself off the ground in any way he wanted to. And he was a lady's horse in spite of his enormous weight. And he did not require the strength of your arms and your back and seat, nor did he require whip or spurs. That was more special to me than anything. And it wasn't until in the later years, when the work got very hard, that he was less of a volunteer. But, you know, I don't blame him. It's a tough job up there. He was a very popular horse. People who were in the lowest levels and people who didn't know anything about dressage would all come to watch him because he was so much fun to watch. And he was so different from the other horses. And how can a very little person like you ride such a big monster like this when I knew, because I was the only rider, that he was truly a lady's horse. And I think that one thing was that, a thing that made him so popular besides his movement was that he was also a big winner. And I was also a little rider and had all to do it by myself. And thank goodness I had a good coach, but I was sleeping on the floor of my horse van, getting breaks and riding lessons from my coach, eating out of my cooler. And at this time, there's no sponsorship, and that's a problem for a lot of people here. And I get letters from teenagers and small children saying, how did you get to be where you are? How did you get to be you? Part of the way I got to be me was that the horse was so popular and so much fun to watch do his job that organizations began to help me when I had to go back to Europe on a third tour, because you're not getting enough, you couldn't possibly get together enough dollars to do it as an individual. I couldn't. So I began to get help, and then I began to realize how many people saw Gifted here or saw Gifted there, and they still come to me. I saw you when you were at, and I don't even remember going to that show. That's how much they remember about that horse. And you still haven't seen another horse since that moves like that. There are wonderful movers, but not with that power and strength. I think the hardest lesson and the most memorable moment would be, I think I said it in an interview, once it takes a lifetime to get to the top, it takes just a few seconds to get to the bottom. And that can happen in a dressage test. And Gifted was winning and winning and winning. And then I got to Europe on my first tour in 1989 as a developing horse, just a training tour. And my first international CDI in this little tiny place, Falsterbo, Sweden, we were dead last. And I spent a long time that evening, I remember sitting on the berm overlooking the harbor, thinking, I don't think we belong here. We should go home. And I thought, well, I'm going to get dragged around for the rest of the tour. I might just as well make the best of it. So by the end of the tour, we were first. And it was a long way up, but Gifted just rose to the occasion, and I had very good help from Herbert Rabine. Next thing I know, he's becoming a very successful horse. And we began again the next year. I went to Europe for training, and went to the first World Equestrian Games ever held in 1990 in Stockholm, where he was eighth. And I made a little mistake in the special, and his little right hind stepped out one step in a pirouette, and I came out, and my teammates were all ecstatic about where I was going to place. And one very, very much loved by me German coach said, "Carol, Carol, pity about that pirouette." So you can see how detailed they are and how strong they are in their desire to be competitive in Germany, and that's where I had to close the gap. I had a very good time in 1990 and came back home to compete again here in the national championships, but I went back to Europe again. But this time, Gifted's strong suit was beginning to emerge, the freestyles. He had always been a top horse in the special because of his enormous passage and his enormous extended trot, and that test highlights those movements. Now he was doing freestyle to Robin Hood. And as you know, that's a big battle, kind of big music, and he would go streaking across the diagonal in his extended trot to this big charge music, and everybody would roar with appreciation, and I couldn't hear the rest of my music in the freestyle. I just had to sort of ride along and hope, because they were either clapping or whistling. They're very much more enthusiastic in Europe. But I went to 3 World Cup League Final freestyle champs in the United States, and then I went to 2 World Cup freestyle championships in Europe. And those were all great fun. They're not anything to do with representing a team, just as an individual. And I got as close as I think an American could get at that time. I was 4th, and that was the highest place individually for a long time for an American. I was right behind the Germans and the Dutch. I think the hardest part about riding in the Olympic Games is the pressure. And the easiest way to deal with it is to realize that you have competed for the last 3 years in Europe, and you've seen almost every rider and competed against almost every rider who's there. So what is the difference about the Olympic Games? The answer is the prize. So it came down to the real survival moment. I was the last person to ride on the team, and it was the last 3 or 4 riders of the day, of the second day. And the habit is for the other nations to, who were all trying to make third place. We were not going to be eligible for silver or gold, that's for sure, that time. And we hadn't seen a medal in 16 years either. And it came down to Gifted's ride, and there was a lot of betting going on that Gifted would not be able to do the job, because I needed a test that was nearly 100 points higher than I'd ever gotten. And I came out and I rode my test, and I have only one wish, of course, that is I could go back in time and ride it again to see how it felt. Because I can see it on the videotape, but it's hard to remember because of the pressure. But I came out and then I saw the score, and then I realized, you know, we had won a bronze medal. And I had some very funny comments about, "Gee, Carol, I thought, you know, you weren't going to make it, and I bet against you," things like that. Or actually another person said to me, "Carol, you know, when I had a lot of pressure to sell Gifted." And one coach said, "You know, Carol, your horse will never win a medal with you riding." And that's when, for sure, I decided that no one would get Gifted. He was going to be ours. And then it was great to turn around, look back, and see your flag on the flags, and stand on the podium and realize your flag is there. First time in 16 years, and it was really fine. I don't know if you're aware of the Gifted Fund. It's part of the Dressage Foundation. It's a fund that was started by friends of Gifted after he died, which amazed me. And GMOs, like NIDA Dressage Association, gave money into this fund. And when I looked at the list of people and organizations giving to it, I was amazed where they came from all over the United States. People gave money into a fund in his name. And now it's one of the most active scholarship funds at the Dressage Foundation. There's one per region. There are 9 regions in the United States. It's for an adult amateur. I think it might have started at $250 a piece, and it's up to now $750 a piece. And it's usually funds just sort of draw down and disappear. Not this one. It's really coming along. And it's a very special remembrance. That's another way I thought that he affected people in the United States, that people would give money in his name. Well, I would, upon realizing how many organizations and people gave money in his name after his death to support a fund that would help other people in dressage to bring horses along, and maybe in this case,
it helps adult amateurs to get away and become better riders. And in that way, I think Gifted did his best job because he actually has helped riders get more education to better train and treat their horses. So he left quite a gift.
You can find more information on the Roma Foundation USDF Hall of Fame on the website at usdf.org. And whilst you're on the website, be sure to visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education. These podcasts are available for download on iTunes to your smartphone podcast apps. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.